This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. We are back for our monthly open clinic segment where we get our doctors to address your health concerns. And today's show, we have Dr. Winnie Chi, President of the Malaysian Dietitians Association, to talk to us about all things related to food, diet and nutrition. And so I think this will be a very popular one. Diet and nutrition matters. Food matters a lot to Malaysians, for one. But a lot of us are also becoming more aware and concerned about how the food we eat affects our health, short and long term. So if you have questions for Dr. Winnie, please call us. Our lines are open, 03-7733-2900. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon, Dr. Winnie. How
good
are you today?
Good afternoon, Shelley. I'm very good.
Dr. Winnie, can we start first by understanding what exactly does a dietitian do? Because we hear about dietitians and we hear about nutritionists. So how are you different?
Oh, okay. I would like to see dietitians and nutritionists, we actually work together. There are more similarities than differences. So nutritionists and dietitians, we are trained in the science of food and nutrition. Nutritionists focus more on the preventive aspects, while dietitians are more specifically trained towards disease management. So the difference in our training is basically dietitians, in the final year, they would be looking into disease management. They'll be in the hospitals doing their clinical training. Whereas for nutritionists, they will be focusing on nutrition science, doing more research. But in terms of the basics of preventive and looking into what is necessary to make changes and guidelines, that would be nutritionists, and dietitians would focus more on disease related.
Dealing with individual patients.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
And so how would someone come into contact with a dietitian?
At the moment now, dieticians are available mostly. Most of us are in the hospitals. So if you have a disease condition, you may want to ask your doctor whether you could see a dietitian. Almost all hospitals and health clinics now have dietitians. Dietitians also teach, like myself. We teach, we service, we do research. You can also come across dietitians nowadays on online platforms. So there are quite a few companies that produce that give online dietary counselling. They are on Facebook, they are on websites, where you can post your questions. And of course, there's always the Malaysian Dietitians Association that can connect you to a dietitian that's specific to your condition.
So do I need to have a health condition in order to seek a dietitian?
Not necessarily so. So if you wish to know more about diets, usually we get a lot of postings and questions coming through the Malaysian Dietitians Association. So we will try to answer those. But if you have a specific health condition, we would definitely encourage that you see a dietitian face to face at in a clinical setting.
Okay. And, as part of managing a health condition, of course, patients would see a specialist. For instance, a cardiologist if they have heart disease. And so as part of that process, how often should they be seeing a dietitian as well?
Okay. Once you are diagnosed with a certain condition, then ideally you should be assessed by a dietitian. We would then see your condition, give you a specific diet plan. The recommendation is that we see you back, say, within a month or within 3 months to see how you're doing. And then once you're quite good and we follow up for a year, then maybe yes, you can cope on your own. And as and when you need to, you'll come and see a dietitian again.
Okay. And so some basics as well about the diet, which I'm sure a lot of people think that they know, but it's worth refreshing because we are facing a lot of diet-related diseases as well now. So what constitutes a healthy, balanced diet?
Okay. I think what is very important nowadays that we tend to take for granted is ensuring that your diet actually has all the necessary food groups that is required. So what I mean by food groups will be you should have your cereals, your rice, your noodles. You should have your protein foods, fish, chicken, meat, or tofu, or beans and legumes. You should also have your fruits and vegetable and a bit of fat, because that's important to give you essential fatty acids. There are not many food groups that you shouldn't have at all, So I think that's very important. The second point is also in a balanced and healthy diet, it's about the quantity and it's about the quality of the foods as well that you eat.
Okay. What do you mean by quality?
So quality would be, for example, if you take fruits and vegetable, if you are just going to eat the same kind of vegetables every day and you don't put a variety into it, now that's not, it's not very good, right? So it's also important to have whole grains, not just, plain refined cereals, right? So all this constitutes into a healthy diet and ensuring you meet the requirements that you require in terms of nutrients.
Okay. Are there such things as good or bad foods? And are there superfoods? We hear about superfoods a lot.
Yes, that's right. Well, as far, I think if you ask dietitians, most of us will say, no, there's no such thing as good or bad foods. It's just good or poor choices, right? It's choices. So one man's, poison, as we say, can be another man's elixir. So for example, if you get somebody who's malnourished, giving them more sweets, more fats is actually beneficial to provide adequate energy. Whereas if you're already overweight or obese and you've got disease condition, then that's bad for you. So as dietitians, we actually individualize the diet according to your needs and according to your conditions.
Okay. Mm. And we have a question. So we also went around and asked people if they had questions for you because we knew you were coming in, Dr. Winnie. And we have a question here sort of playing on the idea of bad or good nutrients.
Apparently, before, fats were considered bad. But after further research, fats were bifurcated into two, good and bad. Hence, the main question is whether there are any bad and good veggies or bad and good protein.
Okay. So, bad and good veggies. some children will probably think all veggies are bad.
Spinach.
Or bad and good proteins.
Yeah. Well, no, not really. So, if you look in terms of nutrition-wise, different types of vegetables provide you different type of nutrients, so you should have a variety. I suppose if you say it's bad vegetables, probably if you're looking into things like pesticides and all that, but not so much from a nutrition point of view. Proteins, all proteins are good. Currently now, of course, you like to choose more lean type of proteins like fish or chicken. If you have meat, then it should be lean. But there's now also a lot of emphasis on plant-based proteins. So things like tofu, legumes and beans, which are also very good, not only in terms of its protein content, but also in terms of sustainability. If you're concerned about things like carbon footprint and all that, so the plant-based diet would be more sustainable in that sense. But one thing about vegetable-type proteins is that you do need to mix them around because some of them may not contain all the essential amino acids that they require. So you should mix it. So if you're having dal, have them with rice so they complement each other in terms of their essential amino acids.
I see. All right. But how do we know, right? What it's not like we have this guide for exactly what amino acids are
okay.
in each food.
Well, you can find out, but I think currently in the Malaysian diet, most of us would mix that. So you'll have rice and cereals with your beans. So that will complement whatever's lacking in rice will be complemented by what's available in the beans or the soy.
What about red meat? Is it good for us?
Red meat does contain iron. It does contain certain zinc, certain types of minerals that is essential for health. What's important is, as a dietitian, I always believe that every food has a place in a diet. It's a matter of how frequent you eat them, what's the portion size that you eat them. So if it's lean red meat, occasionally having it once in a while is fine. But if you have concerns, and you go for fatty types of cuts of meats, then perhaps the saturated fat could be higher and you may want to then think about eating more fish or more chicken,
Okay. Once in a while, though, can be subjective,
yes,
I suppose.
It is.
So is there sort of like an average?
No, there's no particular evidence-based guideline, like how often you should eat red meat and all that. What I see happening is Malaysians actually don't eat enough of, if you look at evidence, that those that really is related to better health is actually fish rather than meat. Right? So we should have about there are studies showing that if you eat fish 5 times a week, it's correlated with better cardiovascular health. Right? So you may want to do that, in your lunch and dinner to have at least fish in one of those meals. The other meal can be chicken or occasionally it can be meat, but lean red meat.
All right. And does it make any difference what type of fish?
No, not really. But there are some fish which are rich in omega-3 or omega-3 fatty acids, right? Which is deemed to be healthier.
The reason I ask is because obviously those types of fish are more expensive.
True.
So do we necessarily need to spend money on that?
But not necessarily. Some of the local fishes actually are quite rich in omega-3, like ikan patin, for example, which is not very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
The more oilier type of fish that we have, the local fishes, I think there have been analysis to show that they're quite rich in the long chain fatty acids. But again, back to basics is basically switch it around. Don't always eat the same type every time.
Of course, yeah.
And I think the more important thing is to ensure Malaysians eat more fish in the first place.
I see.
You know, yeah.
Actually, that's interesting. Ikan patin. I mean, I think because of what we read, especially on the internet, we always think, oh, your salmon.
Yes, that's right.
But
it must be imported.
Have a rich resource of foods available locally as well,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, you brought up plant proteins earlier and just basically mixing your grains and your beans and things like that. And we have a question here about a vegetarian diet.
Can you illustrate a food pyramid for vegetarians?
Ah, okay. The food pyramid for the vegetarian is not very much different from what the non-vegetarian will be eating. So your base basically will be, you know, right now it's the grains, but I think in some food pyramid it's fruits and vegetables.
Mm.
So for vegetarian, it's not a problem.
Mm.
And then if you go up to your, I think the differences will be your cereals will be no different as well. In that sense, I mean, whole grains is also good for whether you're vegetarian or not.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is the protein. So when it comes to the protein level, you'll be talking more about the plant-based proteins, the soy, the beans, the legumes, right? Vegetarians also still need to be careful with fat intake. They still have to be careful with their sugar intake as well and their salt intake. So not very much different from non-vegetarians.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what about for vegans?
Vegan is a bit more challenging to ensure that you get adequate nutrients and adequate things like especially your essential amino acids. Nevertheless, if you do it well, that means they don't take any dairy base or any animal, so they don't drink milk and things like that.
Mm.
So they will have to ensure that their choices of food from soy milk or even from other types of soy milk base, will also give them calcium. You can also get calcium from green leafy vegetables, from bean sauces and pulses. So it can be done. It can be done. Just need to make sure that you don't, you know, specifically cut out a whole load of food groups.
Okay. Yeah. We'll continue on that point about vegetarianism and veganism after the break. I want to find out from you when we come back, Dr. Winnie, about some common mistakes perhaps that people make when practicing a vegetarian and a vegan diet.
Mm-hmm.
We have Dr. Winnie Chi, president of the Malaysian Dietitians Association, in the studio with us today for our open clinic about food and diet. So call us at 03-7733-2900. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio with any questions about food and diet for Dr. Winnie. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to the show on our Health and Living segment today. Ti Xiao Yik here, together with Dr. Winnie Chi, President of the Malaysian Dietitians Association. This is our open clinic show, touching on food and diet. So we have a dietitian in the house. You should definitely call in with your questions about any concerns you have about your eating habits or diets that you're interested in. Our phone line is open, 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp your questions at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Before the break, Dr. Winnie, we were talking about ensuring that you get enough nutrients if you are vegetarian or vegan.
That's right.
And you also said, you know, be careful with your fat intake, your sugar intake. Those things are still things you need to keep an eye on. What would you say are some common mistakes that people practicing vegetarianism and veganism make?
Oh, okay. Well, I must say that both both vegan and vegetarian diets have been found to be much healthier, right? They're quite low in saturated fats, right? Because they don't have animal sources and all that. So it is a healthier diet. And if they practice it good, that means they've got enough fruits and vegetables, whole grains, you know, nuts, seeds and legumes. You need to have variety. That's very important. So don't just stick to one. Right. And the other thing is ensure, you know, sometimes I see people practice vegetarian, but they don't eat enough protein sources. Right. So they only go on salads and all that. That's not enough. So you do need to include some protein sources, be it nuts or seeds or legumes. And if you're, that's for vegan. So if you're vegetarian, if you don't mind including eggs or dairy into the diet, you know, you have your lacto-ovo, right? Then that's also good, you know. So don't just go entirely just on plant only. And there's not enough proteins.
Okay. Are there people for whom a vegetarian or vegan diet would not be suitable? For instance, people with certain conditions?
Yes.
Children? Elderly?
Children, not just... Well, we do have children who grow up in vegetarian families and they do. They are not really stunted and they do get enough if it's well done. So no major concern there. But if you are elderly, if you're going on vegetarian, again, back to ensuring that you get enough energy and there's enough proteins. But if you have certain specific conditions like kidney failure, for example, then you would need more specific diets already, because a lot of nuts, beans and legumes contain a lot of phosphate, which the kidney may not be able to excrete. It's not able to excrete when you have kidney failure. So, or if you have iron deficiency, then you need to really work into your diet to ensure that you're getting the iron sources. Most iron-rich foods come from animal products, right? So how do you then work it into your diet? And you may need supplements then.
Okay, all right. We have a question here via message. What is the quantity of food per meal for the elderly above the age of 70?
Normally, if I see someone age above 70, I would do an assessment. So it's good for you, for the person to check whether your weight, your height is suitable for your age, right? And if you are overweight, then you want to be careful about the amount you eat. But if you're, let's say you're generally healthy, then most elderly people, they don't take a lot of food at one go. So they need to have small, frequent meals. So they usually go for a very light breakfast in the morning, you know. So it could be just porridge, you know, a bowl of porridge or maybe two slices of toast or biscuits, right? Make sure they have some protein source, you know, like some maybe eggs or omelette. They eat small amounts. Then later on, and they always wake up early, one thing about elderly people, right? They wake up by 6 o'clock, they go out, do their exercises, they have a light breakfast. Or they go to the coffee shop, have a light bowl of noodles. Then about 10, you may want to have some 2 or 3 biscuits, you know, or tea and with coffee, you know, that you can have. Then around lunchtime again, if you're hungry, then you can have a proper meal. So it's like, you know, the healthy plate. So small amount of your rice, vegetables, and then also some fish, let's say. And if you are not, if you find certain things difficult to digest, you may want to cook them softer. If you have dentures, then your vegetables, you may want to cook them softer. You don't go for hard types of fruits as well, right? And then afternoon tea and then dinner. So the amount that is required is roughly, if you're talking about rice, maybe one small bowl. And then if you're looking at fruits and vegetables, fruit vegetables, about half a cup, right? And then one serving of fruits and also one serving of fish or chicken. It's more about the cooking method as well, because sometimes they want easily digestible food, right? So not too spicy or not everything is fried. So, you know, more something that's suitable for their palate.
Okay. Is appetite generally an issue?
Sometimes, yes, because sometimes your gut slows down, then you cannot eat large amount of food at one go. So it's important to have small frequent meals then and check your weight and ensure that you're healthy and you're, you know, you're able to do your daily activities. Okay. Then you'll be getting enough.
All right. We have Selby on the line with a question. Good afternoon, Selby. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, your question, Selby.
I'm not Selby. I'm Selva.
Sorry, Selva. Selva. I'm sorry, Selva. You have a question?
Okay, I like to ask the doctor of dietary cholesterol. I understand that dietary cholesterol is contributed to the food we eat is very minimal to the overall cholesterol in the body. Is it true? And does actually dietary cholesterol contribute to the total cholesterol in our body?
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Salva. We'll address that on air.
So thank you, Mr. Salva. You're actually quite right. Dietary cholesterol, that means cholesterol-containing foods, for example, egg yolk or organ meats, right, do contribute very little to the blood cholesterol level.
Mm-hmm.
So the blood cholesterol level is mostly contributed by saturated fats rather than dietary cholesterol. So right now, people are saying, you know, before they say don't eat egg yolks, right? You can only eat it like 2-3 times a week. Okay, so the evidence now show that you can have one egg yolk a day, and it really contributes very minimum to the rise in your blood cholesterol level.
Okay,
but what's more important is saturated fats. That means if you take foods that contain saturated fats, for example, very clear would be animal fats. So if you have your skin of the chicken, or you have fatty meats that contain a lot of, you know, the very obvious white colour where there's the fat there, that will contain saturated fat, and also within the meat as well. Things like coconut milk contains saturated fat, so it can also contribute to increasing your blood cholesterol levels.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's okay to eat an egg a day?
Yeah, it looks like it is.
Yeah. That's the thing. You hear a lot
the
of
guidelines. Yeah, the guide. I mean, the evidence shows that there have been good randomized trials to show that if you include an egg a day, it actually doesn't raise your blood cholesterol levels.
Mm.
The guidelines, however, is still cautious about it. So in one day, they still recommend not more than 300 milligrams of cholesterol, right,
okay,
in the total diet.
Right.
So if you have a good diet that contains whole grains, lots of fruits and vegetables, an egg a day, it's not a problem. So it's not only about one particular food, it's about the whole dietary pattern itself. That's now what people are talking more about. Not focusing on only one or two foods,
right,
but the whole dietary pattern being healthy.
Okay, so that's bad news for all the kale fans out there. Another question on WhatsApp. What about fasting? Is it recommended to fast for 12 to 18 hours every day?
So that's the intermittent fasting kind of practice, right? I think if we ask our Muslim friends who do fasting, we do know that during Ramadan, there is weight loss. Okay, there's also, of course, but not like 1 or 2 kilos weight loss, right? So fasting is actually a quite evidence based that it does help with body weight control. There are many ways to do this intermittent fasting, but when you're allowed to eat, that means in the 8-hour window that you're eating, it's very important that you still practice a healthy diet. So you don't say that, oh, because I'm going to fast, so I'm going to go for my char kway teow, I can eat what I like, right? It doesn't work that way.
Okay.
And it also it depends on your physical activity, right? So if you're fasting, but most of the time you're also sitting down and you don't move a lot, your energy balance is going to be equivalent. So there's not going to be any weight loss.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
But if you are also active and you're also careful about what you eat, then, you know, beginning your diet, let's say around 10 o'clock you eat and up to 6 you don't eat anymore, you do cut down the frequency of your food. So therefore your calories go down.
Okay.
And therefore it does help in weight loss.
Okay. Is it just purely the calorie and weight loss?
Most of it, yes.
Because I'm wondering, I have read about the underlying principle is also related to sort of resetting your body's metabolism.
Metabolism, yes.
How does that work?
Well, basically, if first of all, I think that it does come still from the fact that you're not overeating, right? And therefore, when you have weight loss, you see that your insulin resistance improves, right? Your blood sugar improves, your blood pressure improves. This is still very much related to the fact that it is the weight loss that's causing those changes.
And so in terms of long-term effect, you know, good or bad long term?
There's not enough data that has been done long term on these diets, especially for fasting. But I think if you eat healthy when you're in the window of period that you're eating, I mean, we don't know yet, but if you do it well, I suppose it can. It has no major harm, lah.
Okay.
But don't eat junk when you're allowed to eat.
Yeah. Another question on WhatsApp. Can and should we eliminate carbohydrates from our diets? And if we do, what can replace carbohydrate intake? Should we follow the low GI diet?
Okay.
So a couple of things here. Should we eliminate carbohydrates?
We should choose the right type of carbohydrates to eat. Why? Because carbohydrates contain B vitamins, it contains whole grains. These are the two key nutrients. And it also provides glucose, you know. It's a source of energy. And if you completely eliminate it, then you're going to eat either too much fats, that's what happens, or there's just the wrong type of proteins as well that contribute to high fat. So one should not completely eliminate a food group. So it's important to, but Malaysians eat way too much carb, I know. So we need to go on moderate carbohydrate, lower carbohydrate in the diet, but don't cut it all out.
Okay, yeah. All right. And low GI diet.
Okay, glycemic index is an interesting concept, and it's all about them measuring the index that shows how much it raises your blood sugar of a particular food. And we know that foods which are healthier tend to have lower GI. So things which have fiber have lower GI, but also the way you cook the food. So if you cook it very long, so like for example, for rice, if you overcook it, it tends to have a higher GI because it's quickly absorbed. Unripe bananas have lower GI, you know, if very ripe bananas has higher GI. So it is actually very varied. And if you fry your food, fats also can help to lower the GI, right? So I wouldn't recommend a low GI diet. I mean, entirely just going on GI. It's good to talk to someone. I talk to a dietitian. Let's look at it, because if you have a mixed meal, your overall GI of the diet goes down already.
It's not so simple as you add and there's no formula.
That's right. It's not so simple as that, because certain foods which are rather unhealthy is low GI, right? But I think we have done an analysis to look at Malaysians' diet, because Malaysians eat diet. We don't just eat a particular type of food, right? We have rice, we have vegetables, we have fruits, and then we have our meat. Put it all together, it's a relatively low GI meal.
I see. Okay. But then we also have them cooked in very different ways.
True.
Curries with the kuah and all
that. That's more on calories and fat content.
Right. Okay.
It's very confusing.
I think what you have actually pointed out many times is that there are basic principles that if you just stick to those, it doesn't have to be confusing.
Yeah, I think
when we get confused with diets that come in.
Multiple sources of information.
Yes, and telling you should eliminate an entire food group. So one thing I'm going to ask about is the keto diet. It's very popular right now. And I believe it's on the principle of high fat, high protein.
Very high fat.
High protein, low carbs or
That's
no carbs.
Right.
Is that right?
The keto diet is actually not new. So it was used to treat diabetes a long time ago, before insulin was actually discovered. Because as you know, diabetes is a disease, if you like, where carbohydrates cannot be processed. So when you don't have insulin, what you do is you cut off carbohydrates. So there's no sugars coming into your blood system. And then at the same time, what happens is the body uses fat then. So that's why it breaks down the body fat and you get ketone bodies to be used as energy source for the brain.
Okay.
That's where the word keto diet comes in, you see. Well, what happens in the keto diet is, again, you cut off a whole group of food group that is carbohydrate. And carbohydrate, as I mentioned, is already is a source of vitamins, is a source of fiber. So nutritionally, you actually don't meet your requirements. It's very difficult to meet your requirements for B vitamins if you totally cut off carbohydrates. The energy content of keto diets versus a low-fat diet has been shown to be actually not very much different. So both are low-energy diets. So that's why you would tend to then see the weight loss happen.
Okay.
Especially Malaysian diets, we eat about 60% of energy coming for carbohydrates. So when you cut that out, cut that out, immediately the energy content would go down. But what is dangerous about the keto diet is the amount of fat. It's about 70 to 80% of high fat, you know. And that's what the Eskimos eat. You know, because of blubber and they don't have much choice, right, to keep themselves warm. But, and you do know, if you look at data, they actually have a very high rate of heart disease, stroke and death. So the keto diet in the long term, right now, the safety is, there's no data to show how safe it is. But if you look at it logically, it is not a very safe diet, right? And there has been also recent publications showing that very low-carb diets, such as, you know, not necessarily keto, but low-carb in general, they have tracked a cohort of population and shown that there's higher mortality, meaning there's more death rate in this group of people who practice very low-carb diets. So I think what's important here is moderation, I would say. Don't go high-carb. Because we know that's bad. Especially Malaysians, they don't eat high cup whole grains. We eat high cups white rice, white bread,
the simple,
and all that.
Yes, carbs.
Highly refined carbohydrates, which is not healthy. Okay. So it's important that we go moderation and not extreme in any level, whether it's too much or too little.
But is it hard to convince people when you speak to them about following trendy diets versus the classic traditional advice?
I see what's happening is those who really need it, like my patients who have diabetes or overweight or obese, they are not practicing the low carbohydrate diets, right? Those who are practicing it don't really need it. So it's more the younger population who are more concerned about their body weights, you know, but do not necessarily have a high risk. It's practicing that. So I do talk about reducing carbohydrate with my diabetes patients, right?
Okay.
So, but not on a keto level. But, you know, as I said, it's about, you know, popular diets, that's the thing. And it's usually not sustainable.
Okay. We have Dr. Winnie Chi, president of the Malaysian Dietitians Association, in the studio for our open clinic segment. So you can call or send in your questions, anything to do with food and diet. So call us at 03-7733-2900. WhatsApp at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. Welcome back to the show with me, T. Xiao Yik. Dr. Winnie Chi, president of the Malaysian Dietitians Association, is in the studio with us for our open clinic segment about food and diet. So you can call us at 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio if you have any questions for Dr. Winnie. Here's one about meal replacement diets. So he wants to know whether one size fits all meal replacement diets are reliable and whether they affect your health in the long run.
Meal replacements are actually quite useful. What it does is that it, for someone who has difficulty choosing healthy foods or have difficulty making choices where your environment doesn't provide, you know, then taking a meal replacement sometimes can be useful. So we have, but it all depends on what kind of products that you take. You must ensure that it meets the guideline of ensuring the nutrients, the requirements are there. There's a certain guideline that we have among the dietetic group. And also, it must be also specific. So, for example, if you have diabetes and you're thinking of taking a meal replacement, make sure that it is specific and, you know, it's suitable for you.
Okay.
And also, it's important that some of these products, commercial products that's out there, it's safe, right? So they may put certain stimulants, you know, certain things that we don't know what the content is. Then it become, you know, can we have heard of it causing liver failure or causing death even. So it's very important that you check with someone who knows, like maybe a dietitian or your doctor, to ensure that is this product safe or not for me to take.
Okay.
What it does is it helps to contain your calories. So if you're taking about 2,500 calories, but you need to take only 1,005, taking a meal replacement will replace the calories of one meal of, say, nasi campur or nasi goreng, 500-600 calories. But if you take a safe meal replacement, that's only about 250 calories and a snack. So it helps get that calorie down. So in the long term, it will help with the weight loss.
Okay.
There has been large clinical trials that have used meal replacements and found them to be beneficial, and they can actually maintain weight for quite a long period. But if they don't want to do away with the meal replacement, they need to see a dietitian who can help them get back into healthy eating, but using natural foods.
All right.
So
I'm wondering whether it's a quick fix.
It depends, but sometimes for very high risk patients, you do need that quick fix. Yeah,
all right.
Then a meal replacement can be a good idea.
Okay, if you really need it.
No? Yes.
We have Ananda on the line. Good afternoon, Ananda. You have a question.
Hi.
Yes.
Yes. Good afternoon. Hi, doctor.
Yes. Hello. Good afternoon.
Hi. Yes. Good afternoon. All right. So I was just wondering, What is your take on intermittent fasting? Because based on what I've read so far, that it does help in weight loss.
That's right.
So, but it's just that the hours may also be a factor here, because some say that you have to probably start off with 14 hours and then 16 and then 18 hours.
Yeah.
Then eventually you get to one meal a day only.
Oh,
so,
okay.
I don't know if that's going to work or you know, if it's such thing is real.
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much, Ananda. We'll address it on air.
Yes. So, Jananda, intermittent fasting, actually, there are good studies about it, but not down to a meal. That's not right. So what happens
One meal a day.
That is actually, you know, that's starvation already. Mm. That's not really intermittent fasting. So what it does is that it reduces the period of eating. So a lot of people, you know, within, you know, Malaysians eat 24 hours. So what it does is that you actually, there's a window. So you either do alternate day fasting, mm-hmm. right? But it's not complete fast. All right, or you can do that 6 to 8 hours window thing. So you start at 12 and then you eat up to 8 o'clock, and after that you don't eat anymore, mm-hmm. and you sleep. So then you contain your calorie intake within there. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned earlier, for some people it works. It helps them to be more disciplined in their food intake. But what's important is the quality of the meal that you have on the period where you're eating. You still do should practice healthy eating principles during that period.
All right. Mm. We have a question from Tay on WhatsApp, who says Harry, yes. He has been on tofu, veggies, fine wholemeal bread almost daily on a self-weight loss program. Mm. He's 62 years old, has lost weight from 86 kilograms to 73 now. Mm-hmm. He consumes fish twice a week, but no meat of any kind. Mm. But he says he feels lethargic because of the lack of meat in his diet. So is there a substitute for meat?
Yeah. I think when you're putting yourself on a weight loss program like this, it's important that first we have to determine what's your total amount of calories that you need to eat and how active you are. So if let's say our Harry, right? Harry is going to go at 62 years old, I would say that you only need about 1,600 calories, you know, that will be together with from a diet. And that would mean that if you want to look at foods, if you're trying to put yourself on a go more on healthier eating options. So he's doing whole grains, but you don't have to just take breads and tofu and veggie. Mm. That's a very restrictive diet, actually. So let's say for breakfast, he can instead go for wholemeal, whole grain porridge, you know, or oats in the morning. Mm-hmm. Then he can eat actually some, if he wants to have his bread, maybe as a snack. And then for lunch, you can actually follow the healthy plate pattern. Mm-hmm. So quarter of the plate is actually your rice. And then another quarter is your fish or some chicken, but cooked in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. So either soupy, or you want it to be steamed, or you not fried all the time, but just stir fry, but not deep fry.
Mm.
And then have more fruits and vegetables. Mm. So go on the healthy plate diet. Same for your dinner. So with that, I think it's much healthier and it also not so restrictive, right?
Okay.
So I think that will be better for him.
All right. Mm. Alex is asking about calorie intake. Do we assume that the body will absorb all the calories from the food you eat? Interesting one. If you eat, for instance, 2,000 calories a day, mm-hmm. and you frequently pass motion, would the body absorb all the calories?
Oh, okay. So calorie requirement actually is determined by, first of all, the amount of lean body mass that you have, your muscle. It's actually your muscle that actually produces the calories. So we will usually look at your weight, right? It's also determined by what we call thermogenic, your metabolic rate. Right. So if the body needs to process food, and that's some amount of energy there, the thermic effect of food.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's largely also determined by your basal metabolic rate.
Okay.
Right. Which is dependent on your muscle and your physical activity.
Okay.
So usually we will look at all of this to determine. So for an average Malaysian man who is say about 60 kilos and you're exercising 3 times a week, then you would probably require about 2,000, 2,500 calories.
Okay.
And most of us are quite sedentary. So for women, if you're active, then you also require about 2,000, you know. But if you're not so active, like most of us do office work and all, 1,008 is probably enough. And for men, 2,000 is probably enough.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you want to eat more, you got to exercise more to balance off the calorie intake.
Mm, mm.
So passing motion and all that is actually not, it's not that it's absorbed or not absorbed, therefore it's wasted. So it's not like that. It doesn't work that way.
All right. Mm. We have an interesting one here, which is the reverse of what we've been talking about.
How to gain
weight.
Okay. So again, gaining weight is also coming back to energy balance. So you got to eat more than you expend. But it doesn't mean you sit and do nothing. So if you're exercising, then if you want to gain weight, it's important to still do your physical activity because that keeps your fitness, it builds your muscle. Food-wise, then you would want to choose healthy options, but eat more frequent, right? So you go more frequent. Don't just eat 3 meals a day.
Okay.
You can have larger portions as well, right? But of the right type of food.
All right. Okay. So not sitting there and loading up on sausages,
no,
I presume.
No, yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So comes back to the principles.
Yes,
again.
That's right. Come back to the principles. So more, you know, bigger portion of fruits and vegetable, bigger portion of rice, right? Still go for more wholemeal type.
Mm.
Yes. Okay. And eat more frequent.
Okay. Mm. Another question. How do I effectively reduce visceral fat through dietary changes?
Well, dietary changes, first of all, if you reduce your, if you're overweight or obese by eating a low-calorie diet, you're going to reduce overall body weight.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, it is also, if you couple it with exercise, actually, you will be reducing your fat amount as well. So the best thing to do is to get your body fat assessed, right? There are now a lot of machines out there that can tell you what's your percent body fat, how much of it is fat in the stomach, you know, your visceral fat. And generally, overall weight loss will also reduce visceral fat.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I also understand it is sort of the most stubborn.
That's
type
right. And
of
it's
fat.
Actually someone with the, you know, can have a normal BMI, but you have a very big waist circumference is actually a risk factor for a lot of chronic diseases.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. And another question by Nini. Are there diets for specific body types, different diets?
Well, in a short answer, no. Yeah. I know people try to say different blood types, different body types and all that. In the scientific world here that we practice, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling I know what your answer is going to be for the next one. But are there any foods which are good for the liver, kidney, pancreas and the heart?
Well, the healthy eating principles dietary pattern that we talk about has been shown to be good for all of this.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Mm. What about supplements, Dr. Winnie? Can they be a good way for people to sort of compensate if they're lacking in certain areas?
Yeah. Certain groups of people may require supplements. Pregnancy, for example. You will need iron, you may need calcium supplements, right? Elderly who eat very poorly and is quite malnourished will also require some supplements because they don't always necessarily get a good diet.
Mm.
Generally, the rest of us, if you can get good nutrients and all the nutrients you need from food.
Mm.
So might as well enjoy it through foods. You
okay.
don't really need supplements then.
All right. Mm. Yong has a question. She's currently pregnant and she's due next week. Oh, congratulations, Yong. She has been diagnosed with gestational diabetes. She's gained 17 to 18 kilos throughout her pregnancy. Her pre-pregnancy weight was 55 kilos.
Okay.
She wants to know about calorie intake when she's breastfeeding.
Okay. Right. So I hope she's already seen a dietitian because most GDM mothers should see a dietitian. It is important to ensure that her, she's almost going to deliver already. So congratulations. I hope everything goes well. If she plans to breastfeed, then yes, she will need some extra calories to compensate for breastfeeding. Again, I can't specifically tell unless we really assess her diet. Lah.
But what do pregnant mothers with gestational diabetes need to look out for?
Mainly, they have to control their carbohydrates intake and also ensure there's adequate calorie intake for the weight gain.
Mm-hmm.
But if they are if she's not overweight, then she's allowed a certain amount of weight gain that she mentioned. But most mothers with GDM also tend to be obese, so then we have to ensure that the calorie intake is not too excessive, that she gained too much weight.
Okay, all right. Vanan wants a quick fix. He or she is 94 kilos and wants to know what's the fastest way to lose weight safely. What is the fastest rate of weight loss?
So I see.
How much kilo per month would be considered safe?
Yeah, usually it would mean 0.5 to 1 kilo per week. Would be considered safe.
Right.
I think what he's doing is probably right, combining healthy meals with exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Just weigh yourself once a week and make sure that you are losing that weight. About 0.5 to 1 kilo is safe.
Okay. Yeah. So anything above that would be too fast, would be unsafe.
If someone tells you you're going to lose 5 kilos a week or 20 kilos in a month, you know, that would be unsafe.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, we're running out of time. Thank you so much, everyone, for sending in your questions. So, Dr. Winnie, perhaps just a wrap-up message. It all comes down to the kinds of choices that mm-hmm. you make. And in light of the increasing rate of diet-related diseases like diabetes and heart disease,
mm-hmm.
What would be your message for all of us?
I think it's very important for Malaysians to actually practice perhaps what I would call mindful eating. So before you put the food into your mouth, think about your health first and just practice, you know, sensible, healthy eating principles. It's always come out to be very evidence-based. It's always come out to be the thing to do, a healthy dietary pattern. All the other sort of fad diets or popular diets we call tend not to have the evidence as much as just sensible, healthy eating.
Okay.
Yeah.
They have.
I know it doesn't sound so exciting, right?
They have the sexy headlines behind them.
I know, yes. Yeah, but it's constantly proved to be that's the way to go.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much. Dr. Winnie Chi, President of the Malaysian Dietitians Association, for our open clinic segment this month. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.